Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest today is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. Well, Ken, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
It's a hot day in the old town tonight when it comes to primary season.
Well, you got 10 states holding primaries. You also have a runoff, a Senate runoff in Arkansas, and we keep talking about anti-incumbency, and another senator could go down today in Arkansas, and that could be Blanche Lincoln. You also have another runoff in Georgia. So 10 states plus two runoffs in two other states. Super Tuesday.
Yes, it seems so late in the season.
Well, no, I mean, I just
maybe it's because I'm from Ohio.
Well, presidential things are wrapped up really early, but with the 50 states holding primaries for governor, senator, and the House, that goes on all the way until September, actually, which is very interesting.
Yeah, very strange. In April, you said that Republicans are on a roll in the 2010 Senate ratings, and at the end of May, you said that maybe the Democrats were pulling ahead. Now where are we?
Well, you know, it's funny. Every time something happens, we always think, oh, my goodness, this is a sea change that's going to change the whole thing. When Scott Brown won in Massachusetts in January, we said, oh, every Democrat's in trouble. Forget about it. Republicans will win every seat in the House and Senate. I mean, not really, but that was that was some of the things they were talking about. And then when the Democrats won the special election in Pennsylvania for John Murtha's seat, when a lot of people, including myself, thought the Republicans would win it because it's a socially conservative, culturally conservative district, everybody said, well, maybe the Democrats aren't in that bad trouble, big trouble after all, and so maybe they're on a roll. So, it keeps changing from week to week, and I'm sure after today's primaries, we'll say something else as well. But I don't think the situation was ever as dire for the Democrats or as good for the Democrats and vice versa for the Republicans as the critics and the pundits made it out to be.
Nothing seems dependable anymore.
Well, I always go back to the famous example. This is not new, but certainly polling is just so unreliable. I mean, you talk about no further back than the New Hampshire primary in 2008, when on the day of the primary, everybody said that Barack Obama was going to win it and Hillary Clinton won it. So if we can't predict primaries the day of the primary, then certainly we're not going to be able to say right now in June what's going to happen on November 2nd.
And yet right about this time of the year, I always wish I was a pollster because they're making tons of money. The candidates love them.
Well, they do, and of course, a lot of the pollsters say what they want, what their clients want to say, and of course, there are some pollsters who have better reputations than others. But ultimately, the it's not only the pollsters that are. It's not so much that the pollsters are making mistakes or have poor polling techniques and methods. It's that the voters are in a weird mood. They're unhappy, but with what? They want change, but with whom? So there's a lot of stuff going out there. You don't know. If as the economy goes back, does it help Democrats? But there's also a Tea Party movement that remains angry. There's dissatisfaction. Yes, there's uncertainty. But you don't know which way they're going to go and which way voters are going to go.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie and political editor. Talking, guess what? Politics. It is Super Tuesday. There was a story on NPR this morning about progressives' dissatisfaction or disappointment or letdown over Barack Obama. A surprise?
No, and of course, the Barack Obama was never the progressive slash liberal slash lefty, I don't know what you want to call it, that the progressives hoped he was going to be. Of course, he's not the socialist slash communist that the right wing says he is either. But mostly it's really that, when the Democrats won control of Congress in 2006 and they won the White House in 2008, they thought there would be an amazing sea change immediately out of Iraq, out of Afghanistan, the public option in health care, all these things that they were frustrated with after 8 years of George W. Bush, but also frustrated with 8 years of Bill Clinton, who did his triangulation thing and disappointed a lot of liberals. So here we have Barack Obama, you have Nancy Pelosi in the House, you have control of Congress by the Democrats in both chambers. There was going to be some major changes going on. But now they see deals being made with Rahm Emanuel, and they little handout here to Joe Lieberman, a handout to Blanche Lincoln, a handout to Ben Nelson of Nebraska. And the progressives say, is this the change that we voted for? So a lot of frustration on their side.
And it didn't help that BP blew an oil well in the Gulf.
No, and that's obviously Obama's fault, too. No, and I say that sarcastically because once things start to go wrong for an administration, you get blamed for everything. And so Barack Obama is blamed for everything, for that he didn't fire the head of BP, that he didn't personally go down and cap the oil leak, that he, you know, he didn't show more emotion. I mean, my argument is that I still think that John McCain would have done a better job on that because he had Joe the Plumber, and you know, nobody mentions that for some reason. I don't know why. But, you know, I mean, when a president's numbers start to go down, it, you know, it starts to multiply and get worse and worse. And so maybe, you know, some good news will turn things around. But we thought that for the Democrats, we thought the passage of the health care bill would turn things around for the president. And while they may have temporarily, you know, then another crisis comes. The Israel raid on the flotilla, the North Korean attack on the South Korean vessel. So a lot of stuff is out of Obama's hands. But again, when you're the president, it's on his watch.
The BP oil spill, as well, people are comparing it to Katrina, but to me it differs quite a bit in that it's still going on. We don't know when it's going to end.
A lot of things are different. I mean, first of all, there's a lot of talk about regulation and you know, the leniency that the government, the federal government has with the oil companies, and that certainly predates Obama, but it continued into the Obama administration. So certainly in that sense, you can say, well, everybody's at fault. But again, you know, all there's just so much what the president could do, and I'm not trying to make excuses for President Obama, but he can go down to the Gulf and talk to, you know, state attorneys general about what lawsuits you can have against BP, and talk to fishermen whose lives have been ruined. I mean their livelihood is just like it's just incomprehensible what this has done to people, and we haven't seen close to the worst of it yet. But I mean, he can make all these trips all he wants, but ultimately, if it's still spewing oil out there, and now they're talking about spreading into Florida and the, you know, the northern Florida, and perhaps moving down the coast in Florida and up the Atlantic, because they're expecting tremendous hurricane season on the East Coast. And if that's the case, then who knows where the oil spill could extend to. So I think, you know, the bad news is hardly over.
I was just thinking that Sarah Palin could have plugged the hole with her hair, too. You know, they're talking about the hair.
I guess the Palin and the Michelle Bachmann hair. But you know something, I mean, no, you don't see any more. The drill, baby, drill argument seems to be out the window, and yet not everybody feels that way. Even President Obama says, this doesn't mean we're going to stop drilling. And there are some people out there that say, wait a second, if we haven't learned from this catastrophe that something has got to change, if we're going to still have business as usual, drilling as usual, or dependency on foreign oil as usual, or at least dependency on oil as usual, then there's no lesson learned at all from this, and that's the scary part.
Well, what he's saying is, of course, his lesson learned is that we need new and better regulations.
Well, that's definitely true. I mean, that's definitely what the message that the administration got out of this, and of course, that was part of the whole changing of the MMS and the firing of the head of it, and saying that, you know, and you could always say that, you know, there's been, this is going back years, and this is an administration, for better or worse, likes to reminds people about what the coziness that the Bush-Cheney administration had with the oil industry. But of course, it obscures the fact that a similar cozy relationship was held with the Obama administration, at least regarding regulation, and that seems to have changed.
There, a lot of the stuff we've been talking about are stuff that ultimately he couldn't control. But one thing that has kind of taken hold is the whole issue about the Joe Sestak situation, and now also another race in Colorado that they might have tried to influence.
Well, President Obama said when he was running in 2000 that he would be the jobs president, and he proved it because he's offering jobs to Joe Sestak and Andrew Romanoff in Colorado. Look, there are two different sides of this story. The Republicans say that President Obama has violated the law with job offers to get candidates out of the race, and he may have. There's a U.S. code, I think it's called 600, where it says it's a felony to do this. Now, has anybody ever been prosecuted for this? Absolutely not. Is this what other administrations do? Yes, they have. They've done it going back to who knows when. Obviously, if you're the head, you're the president of a party who wants to retain or at least gain seats in Congress, you want to have the best candidate. So if you think Arlen Specter is the best candidate in Pennsylvania, you want to push Joe Sestak out with perhaps an offer of a job. If you think Michael Bennett, the appointed senator in Colorado, is the best guy, then you want Andrew Romanoff and Kirsten Gillibrand in New York. They pushed out Harold Ford. They pushed out everybody. But at the same time, here's the difference, though. Obama, the administration, said this would not be a politics-as-usual kind of administration. The way that things have been done in the past, we're not going to repeat that. And that's the disappointment with Obama and what's going on here, because it took them a long, long time to explain what was going on with Joe Sestak. And no, it may not have been illegal, it may not have even been nefarious. But the point is that they just let the drumbeat of calling for an investigation build and build until they finally came forward. And then, you know, for an administration that talks about its political smarts, I don't think they exhibited that in this case. And it's not a scandal. It's not even an embarrassment. It happens all the time. But be upfront about it. You know, just don't say, well, we didn't do it. Robert Gibbs, the White House press secretary, had a very bizarre a couple of days a week or two ago when he said, well, I'm not going to tell you what we did, but if we did something, it was legal, whatever we did.
And
say, wait a second, this is not the way we want to hear it from the administration, especially not this administration.
And then in one case, they were saying that the politician had applied for the job. Was that the Colorado case?
Right, there's some disagreement about that. Mm-hmm. Apparently, even well before he was talking about running for office, Andrew Romanoff, who's the former Speaker of the House, perhaps may have had some conversation with the administration about maybe an AID, intentional development position, but that was not the case when he was already in the Senate race. So it's in other words, the White House made him think that he came to them for a job, whereas Romanoff said, no, they called me and asked me if I was interested in something. So that story wasn't exactly, they didn't see eye to eye on it. But again, those are just minor details. The point is that it just looked like it was embarrassing. It just seemed embarrassing for the president and the administration.
Now, Michael Steele, Republican Party chairman, has called for an investigation of the intervention in Pennsylvania and also in Colorado. And I'm wondering, okay, if they go through with this, have they kind of, I mean, forevermore, this kind of transaction, this kind of political juggling will kind of be, I can think of the Gary Hart thing. It's like, follow me. I mean, do they really want that much dissection of this part of the process? Because the Republicans have participated in it as well. They've done it as well.
But that's why they call it politics.
Right.
I mean, you know, for example, you know, when Richard Blumenthal, the Attorney General of Connecticut, announced, you know, when they found out that he misrepresented his military record, mm-hmm. a Democrat said, oh, this is nothing. Republicans said, this is awful. Then when, and so that's back and forth. Then when the Republican candidate in Illinois, Mark Kirk, did a similar thing, the Republicans said, oh, this is nothing. And the Democrats went ballistic saying, oh, this is disgraceful. So, you know, if we do it, it's okay. If the other side does it, you know, we need an investigation. So all seven Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee wrote a letter to Attorney General Eric Holder saying we have to have an independent, you know, a special prosecutor looking into this. Daryl Issa, the Republican congressman from California, said, oh, this is Barack Obama's Watergate. I mean, this is rhetoric and this is campaign, you know, this is campaign excess, but we see it from both sides.
We're going to take a short break and we'll return to our conversation with Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor and political junkie. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can go to allsides@wosu.org and email us, or you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and give us a question or comment there. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
For more than two decades, NPR's Morning Edition has prepared listeners for the day ahead with up-to-the-minute news, background analysis, commentary, and coverage of arts and sports. Get your morning update from one of the most respected news magazines in the world with Steve Inskeep, Renee Montaigne, and WOSU's Marilyn Smith. Every weekday from 5 until 9 a.m. on WOSU, NPR News, and classical music. 69 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:21. Sunshine today and a few clouds, a high of 72. More clouds tonight and rain is likely throughout the night, a low of 60 degrees. Showers and thunderstorms for Wednesday and a high of 80. Looking ahead to Thursday, sunny skies and a high of 84. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Ken Rudin, political junkie at NPR. Ken, I wanted to talk a little bit more about some of those Senate races. I think the Carly Fiorina one is interesting.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is in California, and this is the Senate race that Barbara Boxer has had since 1992. Barbara Boxer is the Republican, no, I'm sorry, is the Democrat that Republicans love to hate, and they would love to defeat her. Usually she wins by pretty sizable margins, but the fact that President Obama has been out there twice makes one think that she might be in some kind of trouble. But the Republicans still have to get their act together in today's primary. Carly Fiorina is a former chief executive at Hewlett-Packard, and she is the front runner. But most polls, and she's been endorsed by Sarah Palin, for example. And Sarah Palin's role today is pretty interesting, and we could talk about that at some length as well. But she's running against a guy named Tom Campbell, who is a liberal congressman. I mean, a former congressman, a former liberal. Well, he's still liberal, but a former congressman who is pro-choice, you know, pro-abortion rights. He supports gay marriage, and these are not the kind of positions that endear him with fellow Republicans, but polls show that he would be stronger in November against Barbara Boxer. So Republicans are torn between having to pick somebody who, while they disagree with him ideologically, might be stronger in November. And I think that's one of the reasons he has faded in the polls. And you have Carly Fiorina, the first-time candidate, the businesswoman running for the Senate. You also have Meg Whitman, the former CEO of eBay, who is the front runner for governor in California. So there is an interesting dynamic going on in California, but in other states, high-profile women, perhaps women who have not run for statewide or any kind of office before. And in this anti-establishment, anti-Washington mood that seems to be out there, this may be the kind of candidates that could win.
I think that someone from the Susan B. Anthony list, that's an anti-abortion rights group that elects I'm not sure if they elect him just to the Senate, but anti-abortion candidates. And
right, pro-life women, right.
Pro-life women. And they say that Republican women will show what it means to be a feminist and an authentic woman in politics. I think that was one of the leaders of that group that said that. And I immediately thought of Phyllis Schlafly did that 25, 30 years ago in my book.
Well, she was a feminist.
I don't care what she said.
There are different definitions of feminism.
Yes.
Not many people will confuse Phyllis Schlafly with Gloria Steinem, for example.
Right.
They're, you know, much different. But, you know, what is a I don't know what a feminist is. Hillary Clinton is a feminist, and Sarah Palin would say she's a feminist, too. And in many ways, they're both right. But then you also have the specter of everybody saying, well, if there's equality, why aren't women having sex scandals? Why is it just men? Well, lo and behold, we have South Carolina with Nikki Haley, the state representative who's running for governor there, and two men said that they've had inappropriate physical relationships with her. She's still the front runner in the race for governor. That's where the Honorable Mark Sanford is term limited, but not run again. So, you know, you talk about equality and feminism, and you have the whole gamut between more sex scandals. You have Meg Whitman in California spending $71 million of her own money just to win the Republican nomination for governor, and she still has to run against Jerry Brown in November. So there's a lot of interesting dynamics going on here with female candidates. Most of it is good, I mean, because the argument against – I mean, not the argument, but the problem female candidates had in the past was that they could never raise the kind of money that the good old boys raised. They said, well, look, I'm a woman. I would love to run for Congress, for governor, Senate. And the good old boys would say, sorry, you know, show me how much money you could raise. And they never had that entree into the Rolodexes of the wealthy. And so sometimes maybe what you have to do is pick a self-financing self-financing women. But right now, both women in California are doing really well.
Well, it's taken a while, but finally women can be self-financing. Like you said, you know, Meg Whitman, former eBay head, you know, Carly Fiorina, former CEO of Hewlett Packard. That's pretty big stuff, and that's not unusual anyway. I mean, a lot of women, a lot of them are big executives.
Right. The problem is, of course, maybe it's not a problem. Maybe they've seen what politics and the cesspool of politics, and a lot of it is a cesspool. They say, why do I want to get involved in that? But, you know, look at these are not business executives, but if you look at the Nevada Republican primary that's going on today to get an opponent against Harry Reid. Well, the two front-running candidates are women, Sue Loudon and Sharon Angle. Sharon Angle is a big Tea Party favorite, very conservative, and, of course, the Tea Party would love to defeat Harry Reid because short of beating Barack Obama, President Obama, Harry Reid is the number one target in 2010 for the right and for the Tea Party. And you have two women, you know, it looks almost certainty that it'll be a woman running against Harry Reid in November.
Isn't Loudon involved in the casino industry?
She is, but I think almost everybody in Nevada is involved in the case, you know. I mean, if you look at what's going on here, you have a Republican governor, Jim Gibbons, who had an ugly divorce, who, you know, is just, you know, is certain to lose this year. You have John Ensign, the other son in Nevada, who had the sex scandal, who's also, you know, it really marred in single digits in the polls. Nevada has always been a very fascinating place to watch for politics, good and bad, and I think this is true this year.
I thought it was sort of interesting the stretch they were making with Meg Whitman in California, the Republican for governor in that primary, that connecting her with the adult category in the eBay stuff.
I'm sorry.
On eBay you can get pornography and that sort of thing and adult style items, and that was just a category that was created before she came on board. Actually, you could get that kind of stuff on eBay before, but she made it a separate category that was screened to protect children from it. And there have been efforts to connect her to that, like she started porn on eBay or something.
I wasn't aware of that. To be honest with you, I get there's a website called All Sides with Ann Fisher. I would get my porn from there. I recommend everybody go there.
No. That's why I have you on the show. We have an email now about less government, and everybody's for that. It's from Debbie. I think the Democrats should cut through all the politics and false accusations that have come out of the Wall Street crisis and the BP crisis. They need to point out that all of the current turmoil is a direct consequence of the legacy of Ronald Reagan. What we have today is a result of less government and less oversight. All that's been proved over the past few years is that there is no way that safety and free markets can coexist. Does Ken think the Democrats would benefit by being more direct and less willing to compromise with people who clearly have no interest in bipartisanship? And by the way, Ken's weekly appearances on the Talk of the Nation are the best.
Oh, thank you so much. That's very nice. Yeah. But here's the thing, though. The Democrats, at the same time, while they talk about deregulation and what the government should do, at the same time, they've been taking money from the same industries, the pharmaceutical industries, sometimes the oil industries, you know, the whole gamut of industries that they criticize and love to run against. Charles Schumer, the senator from New York, has probably more Wall Street connections than any other senator. Chris Dodd, the outgoing, not personality outgoing, but the retiring senator from Connecticut, has been in bed with the pharmaceutical industry for years. And so for the Democrats to say, well, you know, this is the way they should win and win elections by just, you know, running this kind of campaign, well, then they have to stop taking their money. And that's the problem a lot of people outside the two-party system say we have, that for anybody to be a Democrat or Republican, one of the reasons why so many fewer and fewer people are Democrats or Republicans is because they see it as and I don't share this belief, but I understand it, this corporatism of the two parties, that both parties play a good game and say a good game, but ultimately they don't practice it.
Do you think publicly funded campaigns would change that?
Yeah, I still think that there's a freedom of speech question there that the Supreme Court, and certainly this Supreme Court, will weigh in on. And I don't, you know, of course, that's a big controversy with now that corporations can spend freely on campaign. That's a controversial issue that I don't know if that's the way to do it. But ultimately, I think that incumbents would probably benefit, because if the sides are equaled once you're in office, then it's hard to dislodge an incumbent if the challenger is limited to the same amount of money spent as you are. Once you're in office, I mean, the incumbency is a tremendous weapon, and you could do so many things without even having to spend campaign cash to get reelected. So I'm not sure if that's the answer either.
We talked before about the polarization of politics now. It's probably just a cycle, but you wrote recently about the idea of compulsory voting.
Well, there's some people
changing that.
Right. There's some people who, and of course, this was a little policy paper at Brookings Institution. And basically the argument is that, one, the voting participation in this country is abysmal. Two, they point to the Australia situation where now they have compulsory voting. Like if you don't vote, they make you listen to all sides with Ann Fisher. No. If you don't, I'm sorry.
I'm taking a sip of water.
If you don't vote, you pay a fine for anywhere between $20 and $70. The argument, there are two things. The argument is that the people who do vote are the angry, the disaffected, the suspicious, the Howard Beals of the world. You know, I'm angry as hell and I can't take it anymore. Mm-hmm. And so if everybody voted, perhaps you wouldn't get the angry rhetoric. You wouldn't get the extremes on the left and right. Of course, you know, compulsory anything is to me ridiculous. And I think I'd rather have a more intelligent electorate going to the polls, even if it is smaller, than forcing everybody to vote just because they have to vote. I mean, look, I understand why everybody has to wear a seatbelt. I understand that stuff. But to make everybody vote, to getting people who don't care about politics or don't understand about politics show up just for the sake of showing up, or just so we could say that we have a higher percentage, I think is a big mistake.
Plus, we wouldn't need you around anymore to tell us, why did people go to the polls this time? And what do you make of that extra
That would be the greatest tragedy of all. And I wouldn't get those emails from that nice person who likes me on television.
Speaking of emails, send those emails in to allsides@wosu.org, or you can call us at 614-292-8513 and speak to Ken personally, one-on-one, here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. You can also go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, post your question or comment there. I was wondering about ads. Any really good ads? I think the last time we talked, Carly Fiorina had a really strange ad out.
Well,
she's had a few now.
She was mocked for it for the longest time. She had this demon sheep ad where she had Tom Campbell as a wolf in sheep's clothing, which was, I mean, I haven't done acid since in weeks now. But no, but this, it's like an acid flashback where you see these weird things, and then she had another ad where Barbara Boxer becomes a blimp extending from the Capitol and flying over the country. I mean, it was just surreal. There were some very interesting ads recently in Alabama where you had Tim James saying that, look, you know, I took a driver's license and it's in 12 languages. And look, this is America. If you want to live here, you speak English. And that was very, very controversial. But he may have gotten himself into a runoff for the Republican nomination for governor of Alabama. They're still counting. It's very, very close. But you know, even as abhorrent as many people see that ad, it seems to have captivated enough of the audience that might get him into a runoff.
Well, speaking of that ad, it kind of is shades of Arizona and what's going on down there. Did the president do himself any favors commenting on the new Arizona immigration law?
Well, he said it over and over again that he thinks it's just, you know, absolutely wrong. But, you know, not only is it apparently it's 70%. This is very fascinating to me because 70% of the people in Arizona, according to a poll, suggest that people support that bill. And mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, nationwide, people seem to like that bill as well. We talk about how restrictive it is and how, you know, tough it is and all that, these adjectives saying how, you know, it's just beyond the pale. And yet when you talk to people, they say, well, something's got to be done. Of course, everybody thinks that people are just swarming over the border and, you know, killing and raping and pillaging, which is not the case. But of course, you know, there's a lot of fear out there. And, you know, the fear, I don't know if the fear began when President Obama took office, because there was a lot of, you know, anger when George Bush took office, and there was a lot of anger when Bill Clinton took office. So it's been continuing and getting worse. But it's interesting how the write-ups of the bill and what the people think about the bill, the disconnect between the two is pretty fascinating to me.
And I just kind of wonder, when the president talks and others that agree with him talk about, well, if we had good immigration reform, you know, nationwide, we wouldn't have to have these bills. We should be looking at, you know, solid reform efforts instead of these, you know, state-by-state reactionary kind of legislation. And I'm wondering, do you think there's ever going to be the political will out there, or at least in our lifetimes, to do anything to reform the immigration laws in the United States?
That's a good question, but exactly that was Jan Brewer's argument. She's the governor of Arizona, and she said, look, the legislature, the state legislature had to do something because Washington did nothing. And I think other states are saying the same thing. In 2006, 2005, John McCain, this is the other John McCain, the John McCain who supported, giving those here illegally an opportunity to get guest worker rights and path to citizenship. The new John McCain is completely different, and we can talk about that too. But back then, John McCain and George Bush and the Chamber of Commerce were really pushing for this immigration overhaul and the path to citizenship. But the Democrats basically sat on their hands. They let the Republicans do all the work, and the Republican majority in Congress was against it. They felt it was amnesty. They felt the answer was really building the fence and just, you know, closing down or at least limiting the border. And so nothing got done. And so when the Democrats took over, nothing got done again. And so Jan Brewer, the legislators in Arizona and perhaps other states, saying this is just going on. We've got to do something about it. So it's very easy for President Obama to criticize the Arizona law as he has. But at some point, he's going to have to talk to the Democrats in Congress saying, look, this is, you know, we're going to have many more Arizonas if we don't do something here in Washington. Now, again, we have an election coming up, and it seems like we always have an election coming up. But I do know one thing, that there's going to be fewer Democrats in Congress at this time next year than there is now. So if there was an opportunity for the Democrats to do something, I would have thought it would have happened by now.
We're going to take another short break from our conversation with Ken Rudin. If you want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us on allsides@wosu.org, because Lord knows there are better questions out there than little old me can muster. We'll be right back with All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Linda Greenlaw is the nation's only female swordfish boat captain. She commands a salty crew battling storms and sharks to catch fish weighing hundreds of pounds each. How does she do it?
Well, most guys, especially fishermen, have respect for someone who works hard. The bottom line is, can I make them a paycheck?
Linda Greenlaw on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. See a new lineup of public affairs programming Friday nights from WOSU TV. Starting at 8 is Washington Week, followed by Columbus on the Record at 8:30. Continuing at 9 is the McLaughlin Group, and at 9:30, PBS presents Need to Know, a new program with an innovative broadcast and web approach to news gathering and reporting. Watch the new public affairs lineup every Friday night, beginning at 8 on WOSU TV.
Support for WOSU comes from the law firm Isaac Brandt Ledman and Teeter, offering legal services to Central Ohio since 1936. Isaac Brandt Ledman and Teeter, big enough to win, small enough to care. On the web at isaacbrandt.com.
70 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:40 this morning. Sunshine today, a high of 72. Clouds and rain tonight, and a low of 60 degrees. Rain showers and thunderstorms for Wednesday, and a high of 80. And looking ahead to Thursday, sunny skies and a high of 84. And remember, it's simple and easy to renew your WOSU membership. Just visit our website, wosu.org. And thanks for your support. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. Ken, three names, Helen Thomas, John McCain, and Rod Blagojevich. Who do you want to talk about first?
Well, let's start with Helen Thomas.
All righty.
And the reason I'm fascinated by this, because I did a little blog post yesterday announcing what, you know, that she had resigned or retired, whatever you want to call it, from Hearst News. And this is in light of the video that surfaced last Friday, even though it was filmed on May 27th at a Jewish heritage celebration at the White House, where basically a camera is thrust in her face, and she said, "What about Israel? What should we do about Palestine?" And she said, "The Israelis should get the hell out." And then the guy says, "Well, where should they go?" She says, "They should go home." And then the questioner said, "Well, where should the Jews go? They should go." And her answer was, "Well, they should go to Germany or Poland." Now, as far as I remember, I don't remember the Jews doing too well in Germany and Poland. Mm-hmm. They don't have a history of doing too well there. But anyway, the response on my blog was really criticism of Israel and its treatment of Gaza and the Palestinians and the occupied territories and things like that. That, to me, is not the issue here. It's not the issue of whether we should bar criticism of Israel's policy, and I know that's a very sensitive topic in Washington and always has been. There are very few congressmen. Dennis Kucinich, as a matter of fact, I think is one of the few congressmen who attacked Israel over the flotilla raid, where everybody else said, well, it was, you know, it's either a mixed response or it was justified or whatever. But the thing is, Helen Thomas has a seat in the White House briefing room as a White House correspondent. A White House correspondent's role is not to somehow to just announce policy. I mean, if somebody said, you know, send the Jews back to Germany and Poland, to me, it's not too far from somebody standing up and saying, send the blacks back to Africa. You don't do that. And yes, there are free speech issues, but not as a journalist. You want Helen Thomas, you want to stand there with a bullhorn in front of the White House denouncing Israel, do whatever you want to do, but not as a journalist. And I feel very strongly about that. You know, a lot of people have written to me and said, you know, she asks questions that other people don't ask, and that's true. She's gutsy when other journalists are not gutsy, and that's true. And God knows that so many questions should have been asked before the war in Iraq, things like that, you know, questions that were dying to be asked, but nobody asked it. You know, just the policy, what happened, and then afterwards everybody said, how did we let this happen? But having said that, a White House correspondent is not the same thing as an editorial columnist. And Helen Thomas, because she's been there for so long, she's covered every White House since Kennedy, she almost was given a pass to do that. But I think by saying the Jews should get out of Palestine, you know, get the hell out and go to Germany and Poland, to me, that borders on scary stuff. And I think for the White House said it was unacceptable. The White House Correspondents Board said that was reprehensible. And I agree. I it's not a question of free speech. It's not a question of muzzling Helen Thomas. Mm-hmm. But you have certain responsibilities as a journalist. You have certain responsibilities as a White House correspondent. And I think this was beyond the pale here.
Yeah, I mean, I have a hard time speaking up at the PTA meeting, so I found it pretty shocking as well that she would do that. And it is a privilege to be in the White House press room.
It is, absolutely. And, you know, there was, I mean, just the thought of Pat Buchanan or Keith Olbermann, you know, let's say President Bush, and you have Keith Olbermann in the front row or Pat Buchanan in the front row of Obama, I don't want to see that. That's not what I want to see. Now, again, there are some people who will say, and with some justification, the questions are softball questions. President Obama selects whom he wants to get questions from. And sometimes, you know, when we had President Karzai here, not one question was asked of Karzai or Obama about what about Karzai's charge that I would join Al-Qaeda if the U.S. keeps doing that. How could you not ask that question?
Mm-hmm.
So there are so many questions that the media do not ask. And, you know, that is extremely frustrating. But again, there has to be some kind of a line or at least a difference between the failure of the media in other issues and a Helen Thomas comment like that.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org and put your question or comment forward to Ken Rudin, our guest right now this hour. We have an email from Paul. Regarding the oil spill, what could Obama have done when he took office that was different from what was in place? It seems that any attempts to tighten oversight or spend money on preventative measures for oil drilling operations would have been met with cries of government takeover, tree-hugging socialists, and other condemnations.
Peter is about Peter.
Paul.
I'm thanking Peter to thank Paul.
Yeah.
Paul is exactly right. That's exactly what would have happened. And yet, though, there were, you know, the Obama administration was told early on that there were some, that there were clear questions about the safety of oil drilling like this, and just, you know, lack of oversight. And could they have prevented what happened in the Gulf? I don't know if they could have, but I think Paul is exactly right. They would have been met by that. By the way, I just saw something just a few moments ago that if you search oil spill on Google. First of all, Google allows ads to be purchased in searches. So if you search oil spill, for example, in Google, the first thing you're going to see is an ad for BP, because you're allowed to buy in the top box. You're allowed to. So, I mean, even when people are searching for answers and you go to Google or Yahoo or things like that, the first thing you come across is the BP side of it. So it's just, you can't escape this anywhere.
You know, I didn't necessarily expect Obama to enter office and start seeking tougher regulations on offshore drilling, but I guess I was a little surprised that he came out, you know, a few weeks or a week or so before the catastrophe, actually, and said that they were going to back efforts to expand drilling.
Well, this is what drives progressives nuts, and that's a very, very good point. What President Obama wanted to do was to get more Republican support for his climate control bill.
Mm-hmm.
So he felt that the one way of getting Republican support, because I want to be the president who reaches across the aisle, is to increase drilling. Just like, well, I want to get Republican support for the health care bill, so I'll abandon my views on the public option. What drives the left nuts is that they feel that he has a pulpit, use it, that he had a mandate, use it. Whereas President Obama does not want to be, you know, the my way or the highway kind of president that people said George Bush was. And so he'll offer these concessions to the Republicans or the opposition that just, you know, drives them nuts. And drilling was one of those concessions.
We have an email from Tom. He says, I'm finding much more common ground with folks now that the economy has made the size of the federal government an issue. Thoughts?
I'm not sure what
he's saying as far as common ground with what folks. Maybe, is that all the email said? Yeah. Okay, Tom, I need more information.
Me too.
More information, and then we had a caller just drop off the line. Okay, so back to our list of names. Helen Thomas, thumbs down. John McCain, you said the new John McCain. Who is he?
Well, you know, those who remember John McCain from 2000, the Maverick, of course, Maverick is not a word he uses anymore. He is facing a very tough primary in August from a guy named J.D. Hayworth. Now, J.D. Hayworth should not be a strong opponent. He had connections to Jack Abramoff, one of the reasons he was defeated for re-election in 2006. But there is a strong, I don't know what you want to call it, Tea Party slash conservative slash angry element in the Republican primary. We saw that with Senator Bob Bennett of Utah, who is very conservative, but apparently not conservative enough, and he was booted out after three terms. And now you have John McCain, who J.D. Hayworth is saying is for amnesty, who's soft, you know, he's a rhino, a Republican in name only. So McCain has abandoned so many of his old positions, certainly on illegal immigration, and instead of talking about pathway to citizenship and things like that, he's talking about, you know, build the Berlin Wall, you know, build more of a fence, secure the border. He has, you know, it's sad for those who saw him one way, but, you know, this is what politicians do, some politicians do, when they are threatened. They abandon things they stood for and principle that they've built their careers on to get reelected. And for people who once admired John McCain, it's disappointing. But again, you could admire John McCain's argument might be, you could admire me all you want, but I'd rather be in an office whether you admire me, than out of office. And if he didn't change, perhaps he would lose. He may lose anyway. I mean, there's still an anti-incumbent, anti-Washington mood, and he's been in the Senate since 86, and there's some Alabama Republican, my geography is terrible here, Arizona Republicans who say, you know, enough is enough.
Well, because he's got plenty of a record, no matter what
he
says now.
He does have a record, but conservatives always were suspicious of that record. Mm-hmm. He was not the favorite of the Conservative Party in 2008 to run for president, but when you had Mitt Romney and you had Mike Huckabee and you had other people splitting the vote, McCain seemed to work his way in, but he was, you know, they don't like his views on public finance. They don't like his views on torture. They don't like the fact that he was, you know, stood up to the Bush administration on so many issues. So the Republicans and conservatives always looked at him with suspicion, and now he's fighting for his life. I mean, he's really never had a problem he never had a primary challenge, let alone a serious Democratic challenge. He still doesn't have a serious Democratic challenge, but he's in big trouble in the Republican primary.
Is the Tea Party movement, is that more of an influence or is it a real movement?
Well, that's a good question, and I suspect that these are a lot of conservative Republicans who may have sat out the 2006 and 2008 elections because they didn't like the way the Bush administration was handling things. The Bush administration talked a good game about conservatism, and yet the deficits were just out of control. They talked a good thing about not having, staying out of other people's businesses, and then they have the war in Iraq. So you could be a conservative and oppose the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. You could be a conservative and oppose Republican, balloon deficit spending. And so I think a lot of them sat out. Now they just don't like politics as usual. So here you have the establishment, for example, in Kentucky, Mitch McConnell, who's a strong conservative, but he is the establishment there, backing a guy by the name of Trey Grayson in the primary. And the Tea Party folks said, we're going somebody who has no connections to Washington, and they pick Rand Paul. Now, Rand Paul, strong libertarian. His father is Ron Paul in Texas. But again, this is the danger of picking somebody with no political record. When Rand Paul is asked about the 1964 Civil Rights Act, he says, well, I'm not sure I would have supported it. This is what he initially said. Or I'm not sure if, Woolworth it should be forced to serve blacks at the lunch counter. Could it be race? Yes, it could be. It also could be libertarian philosophy, but we had that argument back in 1964. Barry Goldwater said, I'm not against the 64 Civil Rights Act because of race. I'm saying it's an intrusion of the federal government into states' rights. It may sound pretty on paper, but practically that's a losing political argument, and Rand Paul should have known that, and a more experienced candidate would have known that.
We have just a few minutes left, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu. Before, I don't want to forget about Rod Blagojevich in Illinois. I actually had forgotten about it, I'm ashamed to say.
How could you forget?
I don't know. I practiced for so long how to pronounce his name, and I almost forgot how to do that, too.
Well, the Democratic candidate for the Senate in there is a guy named Alexei Giannoulias. So the two of them, it's going to be a lot of fun in November. But here's the thing. When you talk about what the administration may have done to influence, Joe Sestak to get out of Pennsylvania, to get Andrew Romanoff out of Colorado, well, Rod Blagojevich went even further. He was selling Barack Obama's Senate seat after Obama was elected president. He was basically selling it to the highest bidder. And we don't know who he sold it to, or he tried to sell it to. Eventually, he appointed Roland Burris, and that went nowhere. Mm-hmm. But, he was always suspected of having, crime connections, that he would do whatever he can to better his pocket or give his wife a job or things like that. And the last thing the Democrats needed in this very closely watched Senate race in Illinois between Mark Kirk, who's under some controversy over embellishment of his military record, and Alexei Giannoulias, the Democrat, whose family owned a bank that gave suspect loans to mobsters. I mean, it's a great race. Where else but Illinois, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Blagojevich's trials hanging over it. That's the last thing the Democrats wanted.
Now, back here in Ohio, are you still calling the Rob Portman-Lee Fisher race a toss-up?
If I had to make a prediction right now, I still think Portman could win it, but officially it is a toss up because Portman for all his, you know, good campaigning ability. I think he is a good campaigner. He is the architect in many ways of the Bush economic policy, both as trade representative and as the other positions in the administration. And that's a selling Democratic argument. Now, I have always said from the beginning that you either what's going to determine the races in Ohio, and that's especially true about the gubernatorial race with Strickland and Kasich, is that how is the economy doing? If it's doing bad, who do you blame? Do you blame the so-called Bush Portman administration, or do you blame the Strickland Fisher administration? Mm-hmm. And whatever argument carries the day will decide who wins those races in November. I still think that Strickland is a stronger candidate than Fisher ultimately, and maybe
you mean Portman?
No. I mean Strickland.
Oh, okay.
Is a better
yeah.
candidate in the gubernatorial race, a stronger Democrat than Fisher is, and maybe one candidate could carry the other one in. But right now, I still think they're both toss-up races.
It's interesting. Jennifer Bruner, the Democratic candidate, in the primary, Lee Fisher's opponent in the primary, Secretary of State in Ohio, her name was raised in terms of people were wondering or suggesting that perhaps Barack Obama's administration offered her something to get out of that race.
Well, she didn't get out, and obviously they didn't know if they offered her anything. It certainly wasn't money because she had no money. Mm-hmm. And I think that's when, you know, we talked about the women who were raising all this money, the Meg Whitmans and the Carly Fiorinas in California. Everybody I talked to about the Lee Fisher, Jennifer Bruner primary race, the only thing they said is that, well, she can't win because she doesn't have money. And we hear that, or we've heard that argument about women for years and years. And Bruner was the perfect example of it. I don't think the positions on issues were really noticeably different at all.
No.
Matter of fact, I said from the beginning on your show, and this I'm talking about, you know, well over a year ago, that I thought she might even be a stronger candidate. You know, she may attract new voters and things like that, but she just was never able to raise the money, and that is the historic difficulty that women have in running for office.
Well, and Susan B. Anthony's counterpart, I suppose, the Emily's List, was considered a possible, well, that's kind of, you know, was that was made for people like Jennifer Bruner.
That's what I would think, too. And yet, you know, I mean, this is obviously she's not the only person, and she certainly won't be the last person, woman, who fails to make headway in a primary or a general election because of lack of money. But again, I thought that her, you know, I thought she just, you know, Lee Fisher had his turn. He's run for governor before. He's you know, run state, you know, for other offices. Mm-hmm. I thought she was just going to be a more of a fresher candidate and a stronger candidate against Portman in November. But obviously, to their wisdom, Ohio voters, or at least Ohio Democrats, thought otherwise.
All right. Ken Rudin, thanks for joining us again.
And thanks for telling me where to get my porn.
I've never figured out how to use eBay myself. So
we'll talk about that off the air.
Okay. That's Ken Rudin with NPR's Political Junkie and also NPR's political editor. Thanks again for being with us, and thanks for joining us this hour on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.